Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Tonight, I have a very special guest. I have Aaron, the host of Esoterix, and that's E-S-O-T-E-R-X, an excellent blog that discusses subjects adjacent to what you listen to here. Aaron, welcome to The Weird Part.
Hi, Vincent. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. Could you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, if I wanted to sound professional, I would tell people I'm an anthropologist of the strange, or maybe strange anthropologist might be more appropriate. I'm not sure. And when I'm not trying to sound professional, I tell people I'm a Boy Scout of Freudian and anomalistic phenomena, which means I don't care whether phenomena are necessarily real or unreal. I just want people to be prepared. You know, you run into something in the dark forest, you know what to do. You know, you got a ghost in your house, you know what to do. You get sued by somebody who claims a ghost fingered you as the culprit. You know, you got some guidelines on what you can do. So I do a lot of historical research into things that people don't take much of an interest in these days, because you can't get good video. And
tends to be blurry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, there's the old Mitch Hedberg joke that he thinks Bigfoot is just naturally blurry, and he finds that more frightening that there's a blurry monster, a very furry blurry monster running around in the woods, than if it was an actual cryptid.
Indeed.
But I got my start in this very young. I'm from the pre-internet, pre-cable days, when the only thing you could see on TV was In Search Of, and maybe you'd read Omni magazine.
Omni magazine, man.
Oh yeah. old magazine. Those of you born in the 70s will probably remember that. And you knew things like Freudian times and Fate, and those kinds of magazines existed, but you know, where I grew up in the Midwest, they certainly weren't in any of our bookstores. So you know, I had an early interest in UFOs and Bigfoot and the Bermuda Triangle and you know, all the different phenomena, but waned a little bit until my first job was actually working for a magazine on strange phenomena.
Oh, really?
And it was a small press, but pretty well known. And I was the office boy, and I was terrible at my job.
That's often the case with, you know, early career. That's not uncommon.
Yeah, but it wasn't so much that I didn't do my job. It's that my job was sitting there with stacks and stacks of historical, you know, newspapers and manuscripts and correspondence to the editor, and sorting through them and putting them into categories and shuffling them into folders. This is a North Dakota UFO sighting, 1974, that kind of thing, which initially struck me after reading through just hundreds, if not thousands, of these things as an absurd act of categorization. Because you read these things, you have to decide, you know, where, how are we going to find this so we can find it again? And so many of the stories people would tell, I mean, there were lots of ones that are just the same old, you know, gray came down, you know, big black eyes, no nose, landed in the front yard, handed me something, told me about world peace and how we had to do something about the climate. I mean, those stories were, you know, common. And I kept getting fascinated by the stories that had an element of the absurd in them.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, like that. And you can see that on my blog, that I tend to choose the stories where And I choose historical stories because if somebody came and told you that historical story and that said, hey, this happened to me yesterday, you'd say you're out of your mind. And I'm fascinated by details that if you really wanted somebody to believe the story you were saying, if you were either making it up or you wanted to, you know, sort of edit out the things that people would make people think you were nuts, you wouldn't include that detail. And I'm just thinking of various correspondence that I read. Alien comes down, babysitter's babysitting a kid, ship lands in the front yard, alien walks in, starts as your standard UFO story. Alien walks into the house, he's an alien gray, walks to the refrigerator, takes out a Dr. Pepper and leaves.
Okay, now is that an actual example that really...
That was a letter someone wrote to the magazine I happen to be working for.
Wow.
Offhand, you just say, well, this is a little bit weird. You know, and that's a detail you don't get.
I think you make a very valuable point there that, yes, if you wanted to be believed, you wouldn't say that. You know, you'd stick to more of the script. Yeah. And you'd leave out he took one Dr. Pepper and left the house. Yeah. I mean, that sounds crazy. Yeah.
That was the whole interaction. But then there's other ones. They're just fairly common. You know, the sightings of the Grim Reaper, you know, you get them all the time. You know, Big Bang in a black cloak. And there's all sorts of historical reasons that people would see that or might think they saw that. But another piece of correspondence was somebody who saw the Grim Reaper run up to somebody's, you know, Grim Reaper, traditional dress, black cloak, looking kind of scary, probably a skeleton head underneath there, runs up to somebody's front door in the middle of the night and jumps up and down three times. And of course, the next morning, the person who lived in that house died. The weird element to that is the person said the Grim Reaper was wearing skis.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Who would even think of that if you're going to make something up? I mean, that just seems, you know.
Yeah. Wow. But that's why I say I look for these elements of the absurd. And it's because, you know, it's really an absurdist philosophy of strange phenomena that I follow. That and not the funny, ha ha, this is ridiculous sort of absurdist interpretation.
No, but sometimes absurd can be terrifying. Sometimes.
Oh yeah, Well, it's philosophical absurdism.
Disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that, you know, maybe I don't understand the universe, and maybe I never will.
yes, indeed. Those to me are the best, most interesting incidents where you're just left wondering, what does this mean? What is this? You know?
Well, and that's where you get the concept of liminality. It's outside the bounds of what I understand.
Yes, indeed.
But that goes back to the whole absurdity of categorization. Because you get into there's the whole anthropological superior wharf hypothesis that the bounds of your language are the bounds of your perception and your categorization of experience. And half the audience probably just fell asleep, and this is why not many people go into anthropology.
I think the people who listen to this will find it interesting, because you were literally, it was your job to categorize.
Yeah.
And to put UFO goes over here, ghost goes over here, hairy monster goes over here. And to keep those separate rather than weird events, which so often cross all those barriers.
Oh, yeah. Well, in my later career, it has been about categorization, believe it or not. I was thinking about this recently. It's, you know, what is it that I actually do? I do some systems analysis and software engineering, things like that. But mostly I've worked in library automation for 20 years and 10 years working out there in corporate America as a taxonomist.
Wow. Okay. Like literally, yes.
It's all categorization.
And the categories.
The funny thing in corporate America, it's a very, you start to realize mathematically how absurd it is to categorize things, because what you're trying, and there's a practical implication. I mean, libraries, when you get past sort of the public service aspect of them, underneath there's a lot of people doing, manipulating metadata so that you can find things, which means they have to categorize them. And it's an interesting exercise. And if you get it wrong and you miss shove anthropology under sociology, it isn't killing anybody.
That's true.
Yeah, exactly. But if you, out in corporate America, what they're using taxonomists for is to sell you better ads.
That so, is the obsessive drive of so much with the algorithms and everything. Not to digress too hard, but I was listening to something on National Public Radio where a woman who works specifically in generating ad algorithms was making the admission that, and I'm paraphrasing but only slightly, I'm actually afraid of the power that I have, because I can determine by products you've bought who you are to a frighteningly high level. I can narrow it down. This is what, how old you are, your ethnic background, your sexual orientation, your where you live, what you do for a living, very accurately.
Sure, it's statistical. You can make a best guess. And when they came out with all the laws about, you know, don't track me, it presented an interesting problem for the ad sellers. And that's that they needed to be able to track without tracking. That's, we know the last 10 articles that you looked at. We may know nothing else about you, but based on those past 10 articles you looked at, we can algorithmically figure out what ad you're most likely to click on if we serve it up to you at a very targeted level.
That is incredible, and something that has only developed within our lifetimes.
Oh yeah, my last 10, 15 years, it's become machine learning and AI have just changed the entire ad landscape online.
Oh yes, and I'm sure you remember as I do in my youth how they had to try to reach the most common denominator. They, you know, mass appeal. And that is a thing of the past, and everything is niche targeted nowadays.
Oh yeah, very precisely. And again, it's like you said, they may know nothing about you except what the statistics tell them. But those statistics, you know, most of the time they'll be right.
Yes, yes. And when they really have enough to work with, they can really pinpoint you. And to me, it's funny when it goes wrong, and when they're wrong. This is an amusing personal anecdote. For some reason, I kept getting, for about like 6 months, I got at least once a week, sometimes multiple times, these ads from JDate. Well, JDate is a dating site for single Jewish people. I am married and I do not happen to be Jewish, and I did not ask for anything like that. And yet they were relentless. And I'm like, why do you guys think that? What did I click on that caused you to think that? You know? And then it just stopped. And somebody realized, no, it's not.
Well, I just advise people that, like, every once in a while, just go on and do a bunch of searches that have nothing to do with anything you would ever be interested in to game the algorithm.
That is a very interesting idea. Yes. Mix it up a little and see what happens. Yes.
Yeah, they'll hit you with stuff that you'll never look at.
Exactly.
It's amusing to see what shows up.
Let me see here. Oh, I know you've done a ton of historical research, Have you had personal experiences?
Well, and it's funny, I get asked that a lot, and I people are often disappointed in my answer, and that's that I've had exactly one.
And do you mind sharing it?
Oh, sure, no problem. I was canoeing in, and this is actually, you know, it plays into my whole belief that there's a certain absurdism to strange phenomena where it's either, I don't know, I never want to think it's by design, but it seems to repeat. So I'm canoeing in northern Quebec on the Mistassini River. We're running whitewater. And it's empty up there. You go for weeks without seeing any other people. It's a Cree Indian territory. It's old growth forest, empty. One night we pulled up our canoes to look for a good campsite. And the ground there in northern Quebec is covered in this really thick green moss. And it goes down like, from a couple inches to, a foot or two of this nice soft green moss. Great to sleep on. Put up your tent, put your sleeping bag down. Very comfortable.
That just sounds like an absolutely beautiful place.
Oh, it's fantastic. And so we pull up looking for a campsite and we're scouting into the woods, just, 30, 40 feet into the woods. And look down. And mind you, everything is covered in this green moss, pristine, nothing, didn't even see any animal tracks until we got to one point where there was a gigantic footprint, looked like just a gigantic human foot, all the way down from the moss into the dirt.
So there was a line of tracks?
No.
There was one single track.
Exactly one track. It's like something popped in standing on one foot and then popped out again.
Wow, that is fascinating. I'm not sure if you've heard of this, but probably have. That is not a totally unique experience. Have you ever heard of the books Where the Footprints End by Timothy Renner and Joshua Cutchin?
Yes.
They have a lot of examples of impossible tracks. Like there's one track by something that's like 8 foot tall and 500 pounds, but it only leaves one track, or it leaves like three tracks and disappears, or it only has left tracks. Like it's hopping on one leg for like, 100 yards or some ridiculous thing like that. Oh, or yeah. They just disappear. And you wonder, what is this? It can't be a physical animal. They don't leave one track in that kind of a surface. There'd be a trail or there'd be nothing, but there wouldn't be this one that just seems like it's there perhaps to send you a message, or perhaps for reasons we shall never know.
Well, I'm generally model agnostic, but, you could go with the whole ultra-dimensional theory that things just do kind of pop in. And Charles Fort did a little bit of that, thinking about that, that things just pop in and pop out.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And yeah. One of my theories about Bigfoot is that they do rather randomly show up here. And that our world for them is a weird experience, and that they have this, like, when they go back home, they're totally physically real while they're here, but they're not here for very long. And then when they're gone, they're like, what the hell happened? It's in this bizarre world. That's like, there's from some alternative reality, some multiverse type other dimension.
Yeah, makes sense to me. John Keel in The Eighth Tower and Vincent Gaddis in Invisible Horizons talked a little bit about that. They sort of thought that there was this odd trickster element where people who see these things see them, and often there seems to be something to the phenomena that just is silly.
Yes, that exactly. It's like it adds an element of self-negation of that I'll do something that they won't believe. I'll do something so that if you tell anybody, they won't believe that. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's many examples, you know, where something deviates from what we would expect in a way that it makes it hard to believe, but it almost seems like it's on purpose.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people my philosophy is the universe just sometimes messes with us.
I would not doubt that in the least. So let me see here. Do you have like a favorite unexplained phenomenon or unsolved mystery?
Well,
it's probably tough. It's like picking a favorite kid. I mean, you know, you like them all, you know.
Well, I got a couple. One of my very favorite ones is a story from the 17th century. It happened on an island off Sicily, and then it continued on into England. But it's where a ship's captain got sued by the wife of a guy he said he saw being chased into a volcano on the island of Stromboli by the devil. So basically they dragged to hell, and the wife objected to the observation that he was being dragged to hell. And this was actually a court case, tried in court, King's Bench, well recorded. Captain's ship's logs had detailed accounts about it. And the wife lost the suit because too many people saw it.
Wow. And we're talking, when you say the devil, I mean, we're talking like the stereotypical image of like horns and a tail humanoid.
Well, I can go into the details if you want.
Oh, I'd love to. Yes.
Okay. Well, so, it's the 17th century, and there's a certain Captain Barnaby, native to Gravesend, in northwest Kent in England, and he did a lot of trading in the Mediterranean, this time in the Mediterranean, it was a big major commercial thoroughfare, obviously, and there were pirates and the Barbary corsairs and whoever they were fighting at the time, ship merchant captains like to travel in packs, you know, there's, you know, safety in numbers, right?
Yes.
They pulled in, there were four ships that were traveling in convoy, more or less. And they pulled in at the island of Stromboli, I think it's north of Sicily. And Captain Barnaby and another captain named Captain Spinks and two other captains and a bunch of the crew decided there happened to be a big rabbit population on Stromboli, which is incidentally like one of the three active volcanoes in the area. They're Etna, I forget the other one, and Stromboli. They pulled up, they anchored the ships, and they went on shore to shoot some rabbits, presumably for lunch. And they all swore that they saw a gentleman being chased by a figure in black clothes towards the volcano on Stromboli and over the edge of the volcano and into it. And surprisingly, they all seem to recognize this guy. He's a brewer from Kent, well known to the crew, well known to Captain Barnaby. And they said, "Hey, what the hell is this brewer from Kent doing on Stromboli?"
That seems the obvious question for stuff. Yes.
Well, obviously he's being driven in a volcano by the devil, was the interpretation at the time. And Captain Barnaby obviously found this odd enough that he asked all the other captains to record it in their logs as well, their ship's logs. And, you know, a lot of the crew saw it too. So he, you know, made sure everybody agreed what it was. And he, you know, finished his trading in the Mediterranean. And by about 1687, everybody went back to Gravesend. And they arrived in Gravesend. And Captain Barnaby told his wife, who came on board to welcome him home, that, by the way, you know, we saw Booty and Stromboli. And the Captain Barnaby's wife said, well, old Booty's dead.
Wow.
Well, Captain Barnaby said, yeah, we saw him running into hell.
Yes. Wow. Well, and yeah. Again, these are not, you know, this isn't somebody posting something. This is the 1600s, and these are very important official documents.
Yeah, they were still burning witches at this time, you know?
Yes, yes. And but these are people of standing who, you know, aren't doing a prank. I mean, this is, you know, something that they took very seriously.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's probably pretty weird in the Mediterranean in the 17th century anyway. So, you know, you'd have to be, you know, you really had to notice something particularly strange to note it in the ship's log.
Yes, yes.
But unfortunately, our brewer, old Booty's widow, heard of this tale and was kind of annoyed at it because, you know, she thought he was a relatively decent guy. So she sued Captain Barnaby it was for £1,000 slander suit before the Court of the King's Bench, which is why we know about it. It's court record.
And that's one of the things I love about your blog. You go into a lot of court cases, and, you know, maybe it's because I've worked in that field, that absolutely fascinates me, that things are on the record talking about paranormal phenomena.
Oh, and they're wonderful. They're very precise. These are court documents.
Exactly. People are swearing this under oath. It's being recorded. That gives it a certain level of validity that at least we know this person said it. We don't know if it's true. We don't know what happened, but we know that they said it in a court of law. And that, I find that fascinating.
Well, in the end, all the captains submitted their logs to the court, and 12 of the crew swore all sorts of things, that it was old Booty, and that the buttons, you know, they described the buttons of his coat and the same gray cloth as his coat that he was buried in back in Kent.
Wow. And so he died in, physically, we don't know that he ever went to Stromboli.
Well, presumably he died it's hard, you know, given the time that it took to get from Stromboli to Gravesend and things like that. It's likely that he died very close to when they saw him in Stromboli.
Indeed. And so he dies and is seen by people who know him. And when you say the devil, so they saw a man clad in black. One might even say a man in black.
Well, that's true. Yeah, they didn't give a, you know, it wasn't a big red thing with a tail. It was just a guy dressed in black. But we would more interpret it probably as, you know, the Grim Reaper or something like that. But at any rate, he drove him into a volcano, so that can't be a nice thing to do.
No, and it begs the question, why was he so afraid of this person that he's running into a volcano?
Well, exactly.
You know, you're just going to have to, you know, shoot me or whatever you're going to do. I'm not jumping in there. You know? Wow. Well,
the judge's verdict was concluded with, this is an actual quote from the judge, is, "Lord grant that I may never see the sight that you have seen. One, two, or three may be mistaken, but 20 or 30 cannot."
And that, I'll be honest, that carries a lot of weight, especially when they know the person and can describe in such detail. They certainly saw something.
Yeah.
What? I don't pretend to, you know, I'd be speculating, and I'm not even going to speculate on that one.
The widow Booty lost her case, and unfortunately, old Booty then gets relegated to the pits of hell by both celestial and temporal courts. So, you know, poor guy.
Yes. Wow. And that is absolutely fascinating.
No, court cases are just, there are endless court cases that are just so fascinating.
You have a number of them on your blog with people alleging hauntings, suing over hauntings.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Suing landlords because they want to get out of their contracts, you know. All sorts of, you know, legal proceedings involving ghosts, involving all sorts of strange phenomena, which are always, I find, almost hilarious to read. I especially like the insect trials. Those are great.
I remember the episode that you're talking about. Yes. And I don't think I'll do it justice, but please do explain. People filed lawsuits against insects.
Oh, yeah.
Please take it from there.
it happened an awful lot. And they do them against pigs, rats, horses, but the insect ones are sometimes amusing because there's because they actually seem to tend to make deals with the insects, which is the element that I found fascinating.
They had sort of a contract.
Well, yeah, they actually, the court rules on the disposition. Well, the big problem comes up when the attorney appears for, you know, the insect. Well, here's a good one. It's 1545, right? In St. Julien in France, Rhone Alps community, good wines. Weevils were eating up the grapes, which is, you know, bad for business. You don't want that happening.
Oh no, it's a disaster.
The problem is that what do you do, you know, to prevent the weevils in 1545 AD from eating all your crops? And the answer is you take them to an ecclesiastical court. And the ecclesiastical court,
just to interject, so at this point everybody in the area pretty much is Roman Catholic, and this is going to go under canon law through the offices of the church.
Exactly. But it, you know, there's the lines sometimes blurred a little between the ecclesiastical court and what we would consider a municipal court.
There was no separation of church and state. They were they were intertwined as closely as possible, I would say.
If they wanted to execute you, you'd go to the municipal court. If they wanted to burn you, you'd go to the ecclesiastical court.
Well, there you go.
So the weevils, of course, don't typically seek representation. And I suppose because they don't have pockets and no resources, consequently, the state assigned an advocate named Claude Morel to their defense.
So the weevils have a public defender.
The weevils have a public defender. And the judge was a gentleman named Bonavard, and he considered the opening arguments and declined to pass sentence on the lawsuit, issuing a 1546 proclamation recommending recourse to public prayer, suggesting it would be inappropriate to prosecute the weevils because, you know, God made man, but he also made the weevils, right?
Yeah,
theologically, not a bad.
That makes sense. I mean, as much as any of this makes sense.
Yeah. So Bonavard laid down some instructions for what the people of St. Julien were supposed to do, you know, and that involved everybody needed to turn to the Lord with undivided hearts, repent all their sins, you know, live justly and charitably, you know, be decent human beings mostly. And then there was the participate in high masses and march in solemn procession around the vineyards, and that each at least two persons from each household should participate in all these sort of required exercises, which the town did. I mean, they don't want to lose their grape crop. Weevils only live a couple months, right? So they probably quickly forget that they got into some legal trouble. So they actually wound up back before the ecclesiastical court 30 years later in 1587.
So this is an ongoing thing for decades.
Yeah, decades.
This is not a one-off. This is, people took this very seriously.
Oh yeah, yeah. And they, and again, guess who was involved? The ecclesiastical court appointed yet again another advocate for the insects. And
now that's got to be a job, you know. Come into court and defend the weevils.
Yeah. And
weevils advocate, yes.
Exactly. But the advocate was a guy named Pierre Rimbaud, and this time the case went to trial. So the judge this time said, okay, you know, instead of just telling people to go march around the vineyards and say their prayers and so on and so forth, we're taking it to trial. So when they got,
I'm only laughing because it's absolute, I find this hysterical. So we're going to trial on this. Please go on.
Well, so the advocates for the weevils argued similarly. You know, they sort of followed the original trial and said the creatures were created before man and had been blessed by God, and that gave them the right to feed on the grass and all these other good reasons that the weevils were within their rights when they occupied the vineyard.
They're following their instincts that are given by God, yes.
Yeah, I think the court said they simply availed themselves of a legitimate privilege conformable to divine and natural law. The plaintiffs retorted that the Bible and common sense showed animals to be created for the utility of man. Okay, you know, they have their theological points.
This is all being argued in complete seriousness in a court of law. I realize it was centuries ago, but still, it's fascinating.
Actually, and again, documented because it's a court of law. And the folks in St. Julian looked like they were headed for another round of repentance and religious rites, because the judges seemed to be impressed with the defense arguments. But the mayor stepped forward, the mayor of St. Julian, and he had a great solution. He was willing to offer the weevils a deal in the form of a weevil preserve. So they said, we'll set aside a plot of land ceded to the weevils in perpetuity, including like specifications for preserving a right of way for humans across it, where they could live out the rest of their days in peace. And that was on the condition that the weevils agreed to vacate the vineyards and accept excommunication from the Catholic Church should they return.
I had no idea that weevils were members of the Catholic Church, because I thought that required baptism, but never mind.
Well, apparently the argument seemed sound to the judges, and the legal team for the weevils, who, you know, these guys are good, they tentatively accepted the offer. But you know, they weren't done wrangling, because one of the advocates looked at the land set aside, they planned to set aside for them, and found it sterile and unwelcoming, and he could not in good conscience accept the offer on behalf of the weevils.
He's a vigorous advocate for his client.
Yeah.
Which is a bunch of insects. I mean, we're talking, you know, yeah, we're talking about like regular like bugs that come and eat plants, and this is a absurd and fascinating story, and that's true. Just, yeah, I mean, wow. You know?
Well, and so he proposed another Weevil Preserve that had lots of shrubs.
Oh, okay. And get a better deal, yes. Yeah, plea bargain, yes.
A better deal. And they settled.
Did that resolve the matter, or?
Well, no, not at all. They settled on behalf of the Weevils, and they accepted some sort of brokered agreement, and St. Julian today is still merrily producing wine. So obviously somewhere along the line, the Weevils decided to respect the ruling of the court. But like you said, this went on for decades.
That is really, wow. That is wild. I mean, I could just go on with that story for a good long while, but just to shift gears a little bit, what are your views on cryptids? I want to talk cryptids for a minute.
We discover new animals every day. So the idea that there's animals out there that we haven't yet verified exist is not a really far-fetched. They barely fall into the realm of strange phenomena for me, unless they're popping in and out and standing on one foot. I find cryptids interesting because we're talking about animals at this point. And, you know, one of my personal favorite cryptids isn't a cryptid anymore. And I have a weird reason for it. It's the coelacanth. Everybody knows the coelacanth.
Oh, yes.
Been around for 400 million years, died, we thought, extinct 68 million years ago. And in 1938, it turns up in somebody's net. And they drag it out, and there happened to be a guy with in a lab coat on the dock who said, hey, what is that fish? That looks like a fossilized coelacanth I once saw. And hence it's no longer a cryptid. Well, this is what I think the coelacanth is an illustration of, is that if they had just bothered to ask any of the native fishermen, they would have had no doubt, because guess what? There was a local recipe for preparing it.
Wow. Yes. What is often thought of as like some weird, it came from the bottom of the ocean or some freakish thing. The local people knew all about it.
Oh, they would catch them frequently enough that they had a name for it. It was called a gombesa, which means worthless. And they still would eat it. It was worthless because if you caught it in a net with a bunch of other fish, the coelacanth secretes like this oily mucus.
Oh.
And it ruins the rest of the catch.
It might be kind of like a carp, a non-high-valued fish. People eat them, but...
They say the closest relative to a coelacanth is the hagfish.
Huh.
And hagfish are also called the scariest fish on earth to eat.
I think I've seen a picture of one and can understand where that might be.
Well, they have the same mucus, you know, coating on them. They secrete huge amounts of this mucus that, you know, it's terrible. And if you don't prepare them correctly, and because they're so similar, coelacanth and hagfish are so similar, and you don't really want to eat them because what the meat is filled with the wax esters and urea. So if you eat one, you know, you might kill you for a while, but you're going to spend the rest of the evening in the bathroom. But apparently with garlic, onions, and a little pepper, they're pretty good.
That's a temptation I think I could resist. Anything where it starts with like acidic mucus and no thanks, you know.
Well, the point of that is that, you know, all this chasing down of cryptids, just go ask the locals if they have a recipe. You know, maybe it's like, what sauce do you serve with Bigfoot?
Well, and that's, that brings up an important distinction. I would say there are cryptids that are just physical animals that we think are extinct, but may not be, and are not more than that. And I would use as an example, the Tasmanian tiger. They are believed to be extinct, but that's questionable. People sometimes pull up video or photos and say that, no, they're still out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, and with them, they existed relatively recently, and we know they existed, and maybe there's still a few out there. I mean, and that's not such a reach.
No, not at all. I mean, that could totally happen tomorrow, and it wouldn't be shocking very much at all. I would say when it comes to, like, primates, the orang pendek would be something that lives in the deep rainforest in, and I, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's Indonesia. And it's almost never seen. It's alleged to be a much like an orangutan, but walking upright. And the fact that it's rarely seen and lives in the absolute middle of nowhere makes it very believable to me that it might be just be a natural animal. Like, that could happen.
Sure.
The difference between that and, say, Bigfoot is if you had a breeding population, we'd have a body. Dead or alive, we'd have it. It couldn't be seen by that many people and so frequently and be a natural animal is my take on it.
Well, and you would figure at this point even if it's more animal than, or more primate than human, you would figure at some point there would be a curious Bigfoot that would wander in and check out what we've got in the garbage. I mean, it's
precisely, yes. If it was just a gorilla adapted to colder climates, which is something that wouldn't violate any, you know, laws of biology, that could happen. The thing is, we'd have specimens, and we don't, that anyone can ever produce. And there's an aspect there too, that evidence seems to evaporate in a very tricksterish way.
Well, yeah, and that's what I was going to say, that Bigfoot, what I find interesting about Bigfoot is how it always seems to include some of those absurd elements that are, it's like, yeah, that doesn't, you know, maybe it's a hairy ghost.
I have heard that mentioned, that is this the ghost of prehistoric hominids?
Yeah, why not? There were probably a lot of Neanderthals, and, you know, rumor is we whacked them all. And, you know, I can see them being angry and haunting us.
One theory that we killed them off in warfare, the theory I prefer is that they had so much sex with humans that they were just bred out of existence.
A heck of a way to go.
Because I have now, and my research may not be up to the minute, but it is things that have been very mainstream, that a lot of people today from Europe and from Asia have some Neanderthal DNA. Not a significant amount, but some. And, you know, I always claim that to be some fraction Neanderthal. but yes, I have heard that as an alternative theory, that they simply had so much sex with humans that their kids went from being half to a quarter to an eighth to a 16th to what we are now, which is like, you know, 1%. But which is a much happier ending than we killed them all. You know, that's a lot better. You
know? Well, hey, I'm an anthropologist, so whenever I'm walking on the street, I'm looking for brow ridges and occipital buns. You know, as prominent features. And oh, I wondering whether that's a sign of it.
I have a cranial ridge that speaks for itself. Never mind. We should probably leave that where it is, I guess. Let me see here.
But there's all sorts of, I mean, I like really extreme historical stories that are just strange phenomena that are absolutely inexplicable. You know, even if, you know, whatever your theory of ghosts is or your theory of spirits in the afterlife, what do you do when the ghost that appears is just a blue cylinder? Wow. Looks like it's filled with fluid, floats in, floats out. I mean, there's absolutely nothing to justify this. You know, there's no backstory. There's no, and this happened in, when was this? This was, it was the Tower of London, which very haunted, very, you know, ghost bears, ghosts of people who were executed, you know, all sorts of ghost stories that come out of there. But the story that really attracted me was the Edmund Swift, he was the keeper of the British crown jewels, which is a pretty plum position. And
that sounds like you have to know somebody to get that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and he did. He's a relative of Jonathan Swift. And, you know, he was, you know, a mild mannered lawyer and poet, and they scored him this position. And so he lived at the Tower of London from 1814 to 1852. And he lived there with his entire family, his wife, his kids. And as they're sitting down having dinner, his wife screams and he looks up and he sees a cylindrical, he said it looked like a cylindrical glass tube about the thickness of his arm hovering between the ceiling and the table. Contents appeared to be a dense fluid of pale azure. It lasted about 2 minutes. Moved over to his sister-in-law, and then passed behind his wife, and then it disappeared.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
it's like, what do you say to that? You know, that's truly Fortean.
Well, and they actually investigated, and the curtains had been closed. Nothing was being projected from outside into the room, and, you know, there was just no explanation, no way it was a trick that was being played on him, something that was being shined in from outside. And the only light in the room were two candles on the table. So it's like the ghost wasn't even trying. It's like, yeah, I'm, you know, full body apparition. No, I'm just going to appear as a cylinder.
And that just makes you wonder what, there are so many possibilities, but not anything that doesn't fit any storyline, you know?
Yeah.
It has no message to deliver. It has no grievance. It's just this thing. And then it's gone. And everybody at dinner saw the same thing, correct?
Yeah. And they brought in some maids too, and they all saw.
Uh-huh. And you just wonder what's reaching out and interacting with us. Or was that just a side effect of something from somewhere else? That, wow. And that's the kind of stories that I really love. That they don't fit a narrative of, well, this man was murdered and then his soul haunts the place where he was killed. Okay, I mean, I don't really believe that interpretation.
Well, those interpretations, those are like, it's always, they're teleological. You know, it's like you got somebody who says my house is haunted, and then you go looking for, you know, why is your house haunted? There's a guy buried in the basement, you know, who was murdered. It works well for a narrative on a TV show.
Yes, it tells a story, but it doesn't really have any facts to back that up.
Yeah.
And so many, there have been so many incidents where things, no, they're not usually as weird as the phantom cylinder, but you know, that's tough to top. but where entities appeared and said things or conveyed things or did things that didn't match any being a dead person still walking around scenario. And those are the ones that I really find fascinating. A guy that I listened to a podcast called Strange Familiars, Timothy Renner, followed up on a really interesting ghost story in, I may botch the location. It's not Gettysburg, but it's another famous Civil War battle site. And people have seen repeatedly the ghosts of the three hanged Confederate soldiers. Well, he did historical research, and there never were any hanged Confederate soldiers at that place. They didn't exist. That didn't happen. There's no mention of that. And he went through quite meticulous research, and it was never reported in anything. It was never documented. And if they're going to be hanged, you know, there'd be a court-martial or something. You know, there'd be some mention of it. But people saw them over and over. And it's like the idea created the vision. People weren't making it up, but their belief caused something to appear that never happened. And the ghosts of people who never existed seems pretty interesting to me.
I think that speaks to the absurdity of the universe.
Exactly. You're having sightings of something that did not happen in the real world, but something's, I don't think those people are lying. I don't think they're making up a story about three hanged Confederate soldiers, but something's making them see that, or something is wearing that costume, or I don't know, you get into the collective unconscious, you get into a lot of where does this come from?
There's something there, and this is how perceptively or categorically they're explaining it.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of times you have a few facts, a few experiences, and a whole lot of narrative. And that, you know, it's a story that explains what we saw, but that doesn't mean that's the only explanation.
Oh, yeah. Well, you get down, when you do the sort of historical research that I do, you go down some rabbit holes. You think you've got a great story, and then you just turn up something where it's just conclusively not true. A famous one that I'm thinking of is there was a series of new ships that sank off New Zealand. And the way the story goes, and it's repeated again and again, is that one ship went out to sea, sank, but not before a second ship was able to pass by and save everybody on the ship. So nobody died. Then that second ship continues on, and that ship sinks. And a third ship comes along and saves everybody on that ship. And then a fourth ship comes along when the next one sinks, gets everybody on there. Finally, a fifth ship comes by and picks up everybody when the next one sinks. And on that fifth ship, there is an old woman who's dying, who was on the first ship.
She's been saved like five times now.
She's been saved five times, but she's very old. It's probably taxing, and she's on her deathbed. And she asks for them to, if they can, and somewhat, I think she's somewhat at that point, you know, not all there. She asked to see her son, who had gone to New Zealand and was, you know, sailing ships in New Zealand. And she described him, and the doctor, because he couldn't do anything to help her, went up on deck and found a sailor that looked more or less like she had described, and brought him down, and thinking, you know, this will be fine. And the sailor was in shock because he said, "That's my mother."
Wow.
Yeah.
And I understand the doctor trying to just provide a dying woman some comfort, and then
that being an incredible coincidence beyond coincidence.
Yeah.
But there's a twist. Go ahead.
I thought it was a fantastic story. Just tons of documentation. But then when you go and look at the ship names, which were, you know, again, well documented, where they were and when they sank, they happened months and months apart in a variety of different areas.
So, go ahead.
So while the first ship sank, the rest of the story doesn't make any sense. And what's weird is the addition at the end of the mother encountering the son.
And that pretty much, we can say that didn't happen.
Yeah, presumably it didn't happen. Presumably, maybe a newspaper man made that up to add some color to the story.
That used to happen. I'm doing.
But you wouldn't know that. I mean, you could look this up on the internet. You could go do research in a library, and you find document after document talking about this, and never. And you would have to do the research to see that these ships actually didn't sink. Even within months of each other, nor did they actually all sink.
Yes, there's just no possible way that could be true. It's just a good story, and it kind of
got
a life of its own.
Oh, but it's so terrible when you're like chasing one of those stories and you run it, you know, you've done a whole bunch of research and you run into that one piece at the end.
Yes, I've actually had that happen a couple times. That, man, this is gonna be great. I'm really break this open, and no, it's just crap. It was all, you know, it was fictional. It was not what it appeared to be.
And well, you've read my stuff, so I'm always like, you know, as I'm doing it, I'm thinking of good jokes to tell during the.
Hey, that's one thing I love about your blog. It's lighthearted. You know, a lot of people take this extremely seriously, and I understand that, but it's nice to inject some humor into it. You know, we're talking about crazy things, and it's all right to, you know, be lighthearted and humorous about it. I think.
Wait, what's the French word for it? Frisson. You know, the same thing you feel on a roller coaster, both amused and terrified.
Yes. Exactly. Let me see. Just to move things around a little bit. What do you think about dreams?
Well,
and I don't expect you to have a full laid out like philosophy of it or anything. I'm just curious. Just, you know.
Well, I think dreams are I obviously a natural phenomena, and I think a kind of, stop me if I'm wrong, kind of where you're going is dreams as precognition, kind of.
Yes, that's kind of thing. Well, there's precognitive dreams that I find fascinating, and there's dream encounters that seem like a whole different level of dream, and that's something that I've experienced literally once, and I could totally tell the difference between that and, you know, the casual dreams you have every night that are
right. Sort of a lucid dreaming experience, that kind of thing.
Beyond that, this was an interaction with a person who had died recently. I mean, like recently at the time. And I felt that we actually connected as two souls and had a conversation, and then he moved on. And, you know, obviously that's like the most subjective statement someone can make. I mean,
sure.
You know, I can't prove an iota of that.
And you don't have to. It's the meaning of it. You know,
obviously exactly.
There was some meaning in it. And it was a different kind of experience than normal dreaming.
Yes.
And I don't have an explanation either. I mean, certain things that I'm interested in it, but I just, I don't know what to, I don't know how to approach it.
Yes, and it's far from self-explanatory. I just believe that dreams matter. Not the commonplace ones. You know, we all have those. And sure. It's like whatever we saw on TV, whatever happened during the day, you know, just a mishmash of things. But that sometimes, I think almost everyone has some dreams that are particularly meaningful and that tend to be very personal. And some people, and I have not had anything I would say is precognitive, at least I hope it's not, because I had one that I felt so strongly when I woke up in the middle of the night might be precognitive, and that I like texted myself the details of what happened because I'll never remember in the morning. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
And this is totally separate from the other thing I was talking about. This is hopefully not a precognitive dream, but I dreamed that I was in New York City and an alien being that was somewhat insect-like was talking to me and telling me what was going to happen. And we were in like high-rise buildings in New York, and suddenly we were underwater.
Huh.
And me and my whole family, who was not my family in like the real world, like I have a family and that wasn't them. It's like I was a different person. And suddenly I was underwater in the middle of like, say, Manhattan. And it was disturbing enough to be woken up and cause me to record it. But hopefully that was not a precognitive dream because I don't want to see Manhattan underwater.
You know? Or a giant insect.
Exactly. And is a just absolute bizarre, like cartoonish, glowing giant insect. Some things are inexplicable, and that was one of them. But yes, rarely does it affect me like that. But that's the only one I've ever had. But some people do seem to have precognitive dreams.
Yeah. Well, regular dreams, the way, you know, regular dreams that are meaningful, I kind of think of them, but I think of them in the same way I think of tarot cards, for instance, that they don't tell you anything you don't already know.
That is a great analogy that I had never heard before, but yes, that's exactly what it's like.
But what they're doing is organizing it for you.
Yes. I've had precisely one tarot reading in my life, but it was dead on. And it was by a person I'd never met before. I had it at Strange Realities Conference in 2021. And she threw the three cards. And if that didn't tell the story of what was going on in my life, I couldn't make it more clear. It's like, how? It's like, how did you do that? Now, people would say you were reading in what was relevant to you. I can't prove
the
that.
The answer to that is, yeah, isn't that the point?
Exactly. You know, it's not to predict the future. It's so much to tell you what the present, what it is, make you look at it maybe a different way. And that was powerful. It really was.
But when it comes to precognitive dreams, I think it's, to me, it seems more related to how you regard time. Have you heard the theory of the specious present?
If by that you mean, I've not heard it called that. If you mean by that everything is really happening at once and our perception of time is just a means for us to handle it.
Yeah, that's there's sort of the hard interpretation of it and a softer interpretation of it. That is that we live in a moment we're calling now, and we have this notion of a past and present around this moment now. But the experience of now, the duration of now, and all this, there's a very complex theory behind this, that in order to have that, you know, past, present, and future, there has to be a point outside to observe that. And what this specious present theory says is that the duration of the now could vary between people, so that your duration, past, present, future, is ABC, and then mine might be ABCDEF. So seeing a little bit further into the past and a little bit further into the future, because the duration of my now is a different duration than yours.
And you would seem like you were predicting the future, because you can see as far as F and I can only see as far as D.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. I am also very interested in the idea of retrocausality, that some events are so big that they go backward in time. That if you look at time as a dimension where you can go like the other dimensions, you can go east, you can go west, north, you can go south, you can go up, you can go down, that some things are so important that they manage to affect the past and like sort of cause themselves into existence. And that it comes across kind of as fate, but that there's certain things that are going to happen no matter what decisions we make. Other things we definitely can control, or at least have a hand in. But certain things are so important that they're set points. And like, for example, say the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand that kicks off World War I, that for some reason, that point in time can't be changed, because there were so many mistakes and, you know, coincidences that had to happen for that to happen, that it shouldn't have happened, but it did. And there was no way it was not going to happen. One could say something similar about the assassination of JFK, that you can look at any number of explanations of how did it happen, but it was going to happen. And there was no way to change that. And that the kind of rippling back in time, that also makes a lot of sense to me.
But it requires that the element of the fixed point that things kind of revolve around. And with me, if I can't figure out, I tend to shy away from anything that smacks of causality. And it's a reason why I like reading about them. I find it very interesting. Things like synchronicity and coincidence, even probability, all have to presume in varying degrees of we know what this is or we have no idea what it is, but we're pretty sure it exists, a causality. And some of these phenomena are simply so absurd or so inexplicable in terms of causality that it seems to me that we need to look for something else. And I recently wrote an article on this about waves of seriality.
I have not gotten a chance to do more than skim that one, but I am actively looking forward to reading it.
It's just that all these coincidences that seem to happen, you know, because they happen in relation to each other, you want to presume that there's ultimately some cause to this. And forget who the theorist is. He's Kammerer, Paul Kammerer, who is both considered a genius and a crook.
Please elaborate on the crook part.
Oh, he was just considered like a guy who was shady.
Okay. I mean, was he like a university professor or a writer? Or...
Yeah, I think he was a biologist.
Okay.
But he was a very strange guy. He would do a lot of things like sit in a park and record how many people were carrying an umbrella.
Oh, yes, yes. I remember you mentioning that he would make these very strange statistical, like, studies, you might say.
Obsessively charting phenomena and just mundane phenomena. And so what I liked about his theory is this idea that it doesn't require sort of the causality that coincidence and synchronicity do, that sort of unexplained causality. That something happens and there is this wave of seriality where other things happen in relation to it. That we look at, and we're looking at this wave, and at the peak of the wave, that's what we look at, and we go, oh, hey, what a coincidence. That's odd.
Wow.
Which,
and it might be a completely random, like a wave, I think I get what you're saying.
It's related to it, but it's, you know, we're noticing this wave of seriality at a certain point. So maybe we're not picking up other things that are happening as a result of it.
That our minds are kind of imposing a structure on something that doesn't have a structure.
Yeah, or that you can only pay attention to so many things at once.
yes. And that certain things are like a wave cresting at a certain moment, but that doesn't mean that there's some outside cause making that happen.
There's no prime mover. It's just, you know, something happens and it creates the wave, and other things happen related to that wave, but they're not related by design. That's what happens.
Yes. Yes. Cause I think, and not to change the subject too hard, but I think there's kind of an idea sometimes that synchronicities are kind of filling in for the idea of a personal God, that there's somebody who's scripting this and everything happens for a reason. And I think you mentioned that you were an agnostic, and I describe myself that way because I think the universe is just too vast and too complex to be run by any being that we could possibly relate to.
Oh, you're intellectual about it. I'm just hedging my bets.
Yes. I like that third path between religious fundamentalism, which we know all of the stuff that you don't know, but that we feel we know. And what kind of comes up as an equal and equally wrong opposing force, the materialist reductionist atheist, we know all this stuff's not real.
They're disenchanting the world.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And seeing that's a good thing somehow.
Yeah. You know?
And both sides seem to be just comforting themselves psychologically. People talk about the comforts of religion, that if you do the right things or believe the right things, you'll go to heaven. But people don't often mention the comforts of atheism. That if you are 100% sure that you have no soul and there's nothing after this, and when you die, it's just like game over. Well, that's pretty comforting too. You know?
Yeah.
It's not comforting to stand there and face, as much as I can, reality that we don't know.
Yeah. And that's just it. It's like when you ultimately say, I don't know.
Exactly. That's a lot of people are deeply uncomfortable with ambiguity.
Well, yeah, and you have to add to that, I don't know, and I don't care.
Well said, well said. You know,
well, I gotta, when people
talk about coincidence, and you know, I think part of it's what you said before, that they want that prime mover. They want to know that there's some order out there governing it. And but you know, my usual response to it is a quote from a writer, and I cannot remember his name right now, but it's brilliant. He said, once is chance, twice is coincidence, three times is enemy action, and 400 times is clearly an ancient Sumerian demon.
That's perfect. In fact, we should probably think about wrapping up around that note. That is right on, though. I love that quote. I've somehow heard it before, but I couldn't source it for anything. If I can just keep you on the horn for a little bit longer.
Sure thing.
To completely, or not so completely, shift gears, just tell me your thoughts about UFOs and their occupants.
I think as a planet, we smell. And so that's why they don't visit us. Or at least don't make their presence. I'm just kidding. It's an interesting phenomenon. It kind of is where I got into this stuff as a young kid. And that was what first drew me to, you know, Leonard Nimoy. And
yes, indeed.
And In Search Of, love their UFO, you know, segments. I think there's such, I tend to, you know, my personal feeling is this is some sort of not natural phenomenon, but we're seeing something that's, you know, I don't know the word, the word they use is ultra terrestrial.
Yes.
So this is part of something here that we just don't understand. I'm, of course, you know, the whole ancient alien thing, I just, you know, sort of brush aside at this point, because that's not very interesting, saying, you know, why did these people, you know, why couldn't somebody build a pyramid? Pyramids are cool. You know, if you had you can do some basic math, you can build a pyramid and you have the labor force. It's kind of what I don't like is sort of the post facto explanation in modern terms, so that everything that was cited before 1946 becomes a UFO.
Yes, exactly.
And where the, you know, the interpreter, it always gets mixed in there is a lot of those 18th, 17th, 16th century Irish sightings of flying ships.
I was hoping you were going to bring up flying ships, because yes, that's a thing that happened over and over and over. And I am fascinated by it. I don't believe that UFOs are alien equivalent of NASA, that on some other planet, they just put together this physical craft and they're coming over here doing exactly what we're planning on doing on Mars. That makes no sense to me, and that doesn't fit any of the evidence, and I just don't believe that. I believe in aliens, but I don't believe that they come from other planets.
When you look backward at the these flying ships that are described, there's always sort of this modern presumption that everybody that lived before us was a complete moron.
Yes, indeed. I don't want to interrupt you, but yes, that is a huge presumption. And the idea that, well, if these dumbasses had known what we know, then they'd understand that it was just this. And no, people back in those times were every bit as intelligent as us. And it varied just like it varies today. And it varies in other cultures. But we're all cultures have smart people. And they have learned people, and they have people who know what the hell they're seeing, you know, but that presumption is strong. But please go ahead.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking the perfect example of this is there's the 17th century story about the flying ship. I believe it was Ireland, or it might've been Scotland, where the ship floats over, drops its anchor, and gets it caught in a church steeple.
Yes.
And the guy has to shimmy down the rope to get the anchor off the church steeple so the flying ship can go away. And, you know, this would be interpreted as an early UFO encounter, but frankly, these people were not stupid. They know what an anchor looks like.
Exactly. If they were from Alpha Centauri, they wouldn't have an anchor hanging off of something that looks like a sailing ship. That wouldn't be the technology.
Yeah. I can't presume to say what that actually was, but it sure wasn't a UFO.
No, not in the, flying saucer mode at all.
Yeah. But the sightings are so common. And these days, you know, turn on the TV and then you can see a video of something weird in the sky. It's so common. And maybe it's because we have all these recording devices now that more people are out there with a camera in hand that they can immediately use to shoot photos or take videos. But I just don't find anything in the behavior of strange lights in the sky that, like you said, screams aliens, you know.
Yes, not the flesh and blood creatures just like us. Maybe they look a little different, but they're essentially the same, and they've followed the same exact technological path as us, and they're built spaceships that are somewhat better than ours, but not that much. And they have flown here from a faraway place that doesn't fit any of the things that have been going on. It doesn't fit the experiences that people have. You know, people see fixed craft, and I absolutely believe they see them. But I often think that this is a phenomena that is presenting itself to you in a way that you can accept. And that makes a lot more sense to me. And that they've been here for a long, long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, when it comes to people who are reporting actual encounters with a critter of some sort, I find those somewhat more interesting.
Oh, yes.
Because you kind of say, okay, you know, this isn't just something in the sky. It's they're having an experience like seeing Bigfoot or, you know, encountering a monster or, you know, you have ghosts throwing plates around your apartment. I mean, there's something that they're experiencing, and then there's some meaning in that, obviously. And that's why I find that more interesting. Yeah, I mean, show me a flying light in the sky. I don't care, even if it is a UFO.
Well, I've had the fortune or misfortune to live between two airports. So I don't really pay attention to any lights in the sky.
Yes.
You know, they're all pretty much self-explanatory. They've got to practically land on the lawn before I'm paying attention, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Yeah, you can't. We're so lit up now. You know, stargazing, it's not that easy.
Yeah, light pollution wrecks a lot of, you know, the experience of the night sky and how fascinated the ancient people were with that. Before we had electric lights and other thing, even kerosene, I mean, the night sky was the focus of a lot of, you know, things. People were fascinated by that.
Well, it's interesting because it gives you this sense of vastness. If you can walk out your door and see the full night sky. And I've noticed the difference, you know, if you live in the city and then you drive out, you know, into the boondocks, and then suddenly it's like, wow, I can see horizon to horizon.
Yes, indeed. It's very, very different experience. And it does probably open your mind to some things that you don't see if you live in the big city as I do, you know. And to think that all of our ancestors at some point, you know, that was their day-to-day life for many, many, many years. It's not surprising that they drew great significance out of that.
Yeah.
You know, and they wrote down a lot of times what they saw, and that, you know, to me should be taken as seriously as any report made today.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, if you want to look at the historical record, you get, and this is more related to monsters, but you look at, you know, from Herodotus onward, you get these stories about, you know, Greek armies, Roman armies, Persian armies encountering monsters. And yes. It's just kind of a throwaway thing that they're like, oh, by the way, I met a dragon in Ethiopia. What I find interesting is that some of these classical reports, Alexander the Great is talked about in one. He's in Ethiopia, encounters a dragon, you know, and they're not setting up a mythology where he wades out there and does one on, you know, single combat with the dragon and slays it, which would be more the mythological.
Yes, you know, yes, the St. George type thing. Yes.
Exactly. What does he do? He calls in his combat engineers with his from his vast army, has them cook up a batch of what's essentially napalm, and blows the dragon away.
Wow.
And doesn't make more mention of it than saying it was in the path of where I needed to march my army.
Yes. And exactly. And these are completely serious official documents of a military campaign.
Oh, yeah. The same thing with Regulus. And you know, I forget which Punic war it was against Carthage. You know, but, you know, he camps his army on a riverbank as he's marching to sack Carthage. And a river monster comes out, starts killing soldiers, and it was a scaly apparently, and bows and arrows didn't do any good. So they rolled up their siege equipment and slaughtered it with a ballista.
Yes, and it's so matter of fact, like this is absolutely just a normal thing we had to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, we killed it, we skinned it, we sent the skin back to Rome. It was 100 feet long.
Yes. And there's a lot of directions you can go with that. I have pondered whether, and this is, you know, this is, well, in the words of Leonard Nimoy, based on theory and conjecture. Okay. So I always love that. He said it a lot better than I do, but based in part on theory and conjecture. Oh, yes, there you go. That if possibly the dinosaurs became intelligent, at some point evolved intelligence. And if they didn't die out from whatever theory they're pitching now, which at first was a comet, now it's a comet plus volcanoes. At one point, there have been multiple theories suggested of why the dinosaurs don't exist currently. But what if they wipe themselves out in a massive weapons of mass destruction war?
A dinosaur war.
Yes. Yeah. But they wouldn't have all died out. There would have been a remnant population. And perhaps that, millions of years older than us, is what's messing with us. Just an idea. I can't possibly back that up. But we're just talking.
Or it could be just, you know, it could be them just popping in and out.
And that could be too. That could be too. But they could have gone into space. They could have gone into underground bunkers. They could have gone under the ocean. And periodically, something left over from a different era shows up. And perhaps through a time slip, perhaps from another dimension, many different ways, and people encounter it and are just like, what the hell is this monster? You know? And that's one thing, you cover a lot of monsters and it's very interesting.
Well, I like stories of monsters that are, again, it has to have that element of the absurd. I think I did one on, I'm going to get this name entirely wrong. I think it's Lake Koshnikong in Wisconsin.
Oh, yes. If you hadn't brought it up, I had that noted to bring that up. Please, go ahead.
They had sort of the native Potawatomi tribes and then the settlers that came after them and lived around this lake, which its name in Potawatomi means something like the catfish place. So it's not named after the monster, but there's known to be a what they call the demon that lives in the lake. And you have to, if you're going to cross the lake in a canoe, you have to put a little bit of tobacco in the water to sort of propitiate the demon of the lake. And then he'll let you cross. If you don't do that, he'll overturn your canoe, drag you to the bottom of the lake, and eat you.
Yes, yes.
And
go ahead.
I like the idea that there's a monster out there in a lake in Wisconsin who has a nicotine habit. and you know, you'd be surly too if they named your lake after the catfish instead of you, and you weren't getting regular amounts of tobacco. You know, you get grumpy when you stop smoking.
Yes. But just to put that in perspective, think about it. That can't be a natural being, like just a big catfish.
Yeah, or, exactly.
You know, it has specific demands. It has an intelligence. It's something. I don't know what it is, but it's definitely something. And that's not the only lake in Wisconsin with that kind of situation, or something very close to it. There are a number. There's Devil's Lake, where there's an extensive Ho-Chunk tradition of these things that are evil spirits that live in the lake, which may be a portal to another dimension at the bottom of the lake. And they sometimes kidnap people and is a center of great weirdness. And that seems to go around a lot of places.
Yeah. Yeah. You see small lakes, you know, there's always some tradition for almost any lake you can find. I mean, forget the big lakes. They have their monsters. But like all those small lakes up there in the upper Midwest, most of them have something associated with them.
Yes. Yes, indeed. We're kind of running a little short on time.
Okay.
But I would really like to thank you for being here, Aaron. Oh, and sure. Is there anything you'd like to share before we kind of wrap things up?
If people want to read more, you can go to my website. It's esoterix.com, ESOTERX.com. If you misspell it, you'll get a chemical company.
You certainly will, but
but it's basically you'll be able to read all the things that I got some neurotic notion in my head that we should be scared about, and I try to detail what to do when it happens.
And you do an excellent job, and I can't tell listeners how good this pod. How good his blog is. It's absolutely fascinating. If you listen to this, you're going to want to read that. And he keeps it interesting, keeps it somewhat humorous, and just has stories you will not find anywhere else. And I've been reading it for years. I should have had him on sooner. This has been The Weird Part. I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Thank you for listening, and good night.
Good night.